Chapter 9. Venezuela Libre. Venezuela's illegitimate regime, one of the Western Hemisphere's most oppressive, presented the Trump administration an opportunity. But it required steady determination on our part and consistent, all-out, unrelenting pressure. We failed to meet this standard. The president vacillated and wobbled, exacerbating internal administration disagreements rather than resolving them, and repeatedly impeding our efforts to carry out a policy. We were never overconfident of success supporting the Venezuelan opposition's efforts to replace Nicolas Maduro, Hugo Chavez's heir. It was almost the opposite. Maduro's opponents acted in January 2019 because they felt strongly this could be their last opportunity for freedom after years of trying and failing. America responded because it was in our national interest to do so. It still is, and the struggle continues. After the unsuccessful efforts to oust Maduro, the Trump administration did not hesitate to discuss publicly, in detail, how close the opposition had come to ousting Maduro, and what had gone wrong. Numerous press stories repeated details of what we had continuously heard from the opposition during 2019, and which are discussed in this text. This was hardly a normal situation of diplomatic conversations and exchanges, and we heard as well from many members of Congress and private U.S. citizens, especially members of the Cuban-American and Venezuelan-American communities in Florida. Someday, when Venezuela is free again, the many individuals supporting the opposition will be free to tell their stories publicly. Until then, we have only the memories of people like myself, fortunate enough to be able to tell their stories for them. There is a two-decade-long history of missed opportunities in Venezuela, given the widespread, strongly held opposition to the Chavez-Maduro regime. Shortly after I became National Security Advisor, while Maduro was speaking at a military awards ceremony on August 4th, he was attacked by two drones. While the attack failed, it showed vigorous dissent within the military. And the hilarious pictures of service members fleeing energetically at the sound of explosions, despite regime propaganda, showed just how loyal the military was to Maduro. Maduro's autocratic regime was a threat due to its Cuba connection and the openings it afforded Russia, China, and Iran. Moscow's menace was undeniable, both military and financial, having expended substantial resources to buttress Maduro, dominate Venezuela's oil and gas industry, and impose costs on the U.S. Beijing was not far behind. Trump saw this, telling me after a New Year's Day 2019 call with Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi that he worried about Russia and China. "I don't want to be sitting around watching." Venezuela hadn't topped my priorities when I started, but competent national security management requires flexibility when new threats or opportunities arise. Venezuela was just such a contingency. America had opposed external threats in the Western Hemisphere since the Monroe Doctrine, and it was time to resurrect it after the Obama-Kerry efforts to bury it. Venezuela was a threat on its own account, as demonstrated in a December 22nd incident at sea along the Guyana-Venezuela border. Venezuelan naval units tried to board ExxonMobil exploration ships under licenses from Guyana in its territorial waters. Chavez and Maduro had run Venezuela's oil and gas industry into a ditch, and extensive hydrocarbon resources in Guyana would pose an immediate competitive threat right next door. The incident evaporated as the exploration ships, after refusing Venezuelan requests to land a chopper on board one of them, headed rapidly back into undeniably Guyanese waters. Shortly after the drone attack, during an unrelated meeting on August 15th, Venezuela came up, and Trump said to me emphatically, "Get it done," meaning get rid of the Maduro regime. "This is the fifth time I've asked for it," he continued. I described the thinking we were doing in a meeting now slimmed down to just Kelly and me, but Trump insisted he wanted military options for Venezuela and then keep it, because it's really part of the United States. This presidential interest in discussing military options initially surprised me, but it shouldn't have. As I learned, Trump had previously advocated it, responding to a press question almost exactly 1 year earlier on August 11, 2017, at Bedminster, New Jersey. "We have many options for Venezuela, and by the way, I'm not going to rule out a military option. We have many options for Venezuela. This is our neighbor. We're all over the world, and we have troops all over the world in places that are very, very far away. Venezuela is not very far away, and the people are suffering, and they're dying. We have many options for Venezuela, including a possible military option if necessary." I explained why military force was not the answer, especially given the inevitable congressional opposition, but that we could accomplish the same objective by working with Maduro's opponents. I subsequently decided to turn a spotlight on Venezuela, giving a widely covered speech in Miami on November 1, 2018, in which I condemned the Western Hemisphere's troika of tyranny: Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua. I announced that the administration, in its ongoing reversal of Obama's Cuba policy, would impose new sanctions against Havana and also carry out a new executive order sanctioning Venezuela's gold sector, which the regime used to keep itself afloat by selling gold from Venezuela's central bank. The Troika of Tyranny speech underlined the affiliations between all three authoritarian governments, laying the basis for a more forward-leaning policy. Trump liked the phrase "Troika of Tyranny," telling me, "You give such great speeches." This one, as I pointed out, had been written by one of his own speechwriters. Of course, Trump also periodically said that he wanted to meet with Maduro to resolve all our problems with Venezuela, which neither Pompeo nor I thought was a good idea. At one point in December, I ran into Rudy Giuliani in the West Wing. He asked to come see me after a meeting of Trump's lawyers, which was why he was there. He had a message for Trump from Representative Pete Sessions, who had long advocated Trump meet with Maduro, as had Senator Bob Corker, for reasons best known to themselves. Discussing this later, Pompeo suggested we first send someone to Venezuela to see Maduro, although as Trump's interest in talking with Maduro waned thereafter, nothing happened. The big bang in Venezuela came on Friday, January 11th. The new young president of the National Assembly, Juan Guaido, announced at a huge rally in Caracas that the assembly believed Maduro's manifestly fraudulent 2018 re-election was illegitimate and therefore invalid. Accordingly, the assembly, Venezuela's only legitimate, popularly elected institution, had declared the Venezuelan presidency vacant. Under the vacancy clause of Hugo Chavez's own constitution, Guaido said he would become interim president on January 23rd, which was the anniversary of the 1958 military coup that overthrew the Marcos Perez Jimenez dictatorship and ousted Maduro to prepare new elections. The U.S. had only late word the National Assembly would move in this direction. We played no role in encouraging or assisting the opposition. They saw this moment as possibly their last chance. It was now all on the line in Venezuela, and we had to decide how to respond. Sit and watch, or act? I had no doubt what we should do. The revolution was on. I told Mauricio Claver Caron, whom I had recently chosen as NSC Senior Director for the Western Hemisphere, to issue a statement of support. I briefed Trump on what had happened, interrupting a meeting with an outsider that had already run past its scheduled end. Trump, though, was irritated at being informed of only a possible change in Venezuela, saying I should put the statement out in my name, not his. I could have reminded him he had said not 10 days before, "I don't want to be sitting around watching," and probably should have, but I just issued the statement as my own. Maduro reacted harshly, threatening National Assembly members and their families. Guaido himself was arrested by one of the regime's secret police forces, but then quickly released. There was speculation it was actually Cubans who seized Guaido, but his release indicated real confusion in the regime, a good sign. I also tweeted the first of many Venezuela tweets to come condemning the Maduro dictatorship's arrest of Guaido. I was heartened that Maduro's government promptly accused me of leading a coup against Venezuela's democracy, an approach followed by other adversaries who attacked Trump's advisors. More important, we began devising steps to take immediately against Maduro's regime, and also Cuba, its protector and likely controller, and Nicaragua. Why not go after all three at once? Oil sanctions were a natural choice, but why not declare Venezuela a state sponsor of terrorism, something I first suggested on October 1, 2018, and also return Cuba to the list after Obama had removed it? Under Chavez and now Maduro, Venezuela's revenues from petroleum-related exports had dropped dramatically as production itself fell from approximately 3.3 million barrels of oil pumped per day when Chavez took power in 1999 to approximately 1.1 million barrels per day in January 2019. This precipitous decline, dropping Venezuela to production levels not seen since the 1940s, had already substantially impoverished the country. Driving the state-owned oil monopoly's production as low as possible, which the opposition fully supported, might well have been enough to crash Maduro's regime. There were many other sanctions necessary to eliminate the regime's illicit income streams, especially drug trafficking with narco-terrorists operating primarily in Colombia, with safe havens in Venezuela, but striking the oil company was key. On January 14th, I convened a principals committee in the SIT room to consider our options for sanctioning the Maduro regime, especially the petroleum sector. I thought it was time to turn the screws and asked, why don't we go for a win here? It rapidly became clear that everyone wanted to take decisive action except Treasury Secretary Mnuchin. He wanted to do little or nothing, arguing that if we acted, it risked Maduro's nationalizing what little remained of U.S. oil sector investments in Venezuela and raising international oil prices. Mnuchin essentially wanted a guarantee we would succeed, with Maduro overthrown if we imposed sanctions. That, of course, was impossible. If I have one memory of Mnuchin from the administration, and there were many carbon copies of this one, Mnuchin opposing tough measures, especially against China, this is it. Why were our sanctions often not as sweeping and effective as they might have been? Listen no further. As Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, a renowned financier, much more politically conservative than Mnuchin, who was basically a Democrat, said to me in April, Stevens more worried about secondary effects on U.S. companies than about the mission, which was completely accurate. Mnuchin's argument for passivity was entirely economic, so it was important that Larry Kudlow weighed in quickly to say, John's view is my view too. Keith Kellogg added that Pence believed we should be going all out against Venezuela's state-owned oil company. That had enormous effect, since Pence rarely offered his views in such settings to avoid boxing in the president. Pompeo was traveling, but Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan argued for sanctions, although not with great specificity. Energy Secretary Rick Perry was strongly in favor of tough sanctions, sweeping aside Mnuchin's concerns about the limited U.S. oil and gas assets in Venezuela. Mnuchin was a minority of one, so I said we should send Trump a split decision memo. Everyone should get their arguments in quickly because we were moving fast. Pence had earlier offered to call Guaido to express our support, which, after hearing Mnuchin, I thought was a good idea. The call went well, increasing the urgency that America react with something more than just rhetoric praising Venezuela's National Assembly. Nonetheless, Mnuchin kept up his campaign for doing nothing. Pompeo told me he had a 30-minute call with Mnuchin on Thursday and had counterproposed doing the sanctions in slices. I responded that we had a shot to overthrow Maduro now, and it might be a long, long time before we had another one as good. Half measures weren't going to cut it. Pompeo agreed we didn't want to replicate Obama in 2009, watching pro-democracy protests in Iran suppressed while the U.S. did nothing. That sounded like Pompeo was moving in the right direction. Even the Organization of American States, long one of the most moribund international organizations, and that's saying something, was roused to help Guaido as a growing number of Latin American countries stood up to declare support for Venezuela's defiant National Assembly. The mere fact Guaido remained free showed we had a chance. We needed Trump's decision on sanctions and whether to recognize Guaido as the legitimate interim president when he crossed the Rubicon on January 23rd. On the 21st, I explained to Trump the possible political and economic steps to take against Maduro and said a lot depended on what happened 2 days later. Trump doubted Maduro would fall, saying he's too smart and too tough, which was yet another surprise given earlier comments on the regime's stability. He had said just a short time before on September 25, 2018 in New York that it's a regime that, frankly, could be toppled very quickly by the military if the military decides to do that. Trump added that he also wanted the fullest range of options against the regime, which request I conveyed to Dunford later in the day. Dunford and I also discussed what might be required if things went badly in Caracas, potentially endangering the lives of official U.S. personnel and even private U.S. citizens there, thereby perhaps necessitating a non-permissive evacuation of those in danger. The more I thought about it, the more I realized the decision on political recognition was more important now than the oil sanctions. First, U.S. recognition would have major implications for the Federal Reserve Board and therefore banks worldwide. The Fed would automatically turn control over Venezuelan government assets it possessed to the Guaido-led administration. Unfortunately, as we were to find, Maduro's regime had been so proficient at stealing or squandering those assets, there weren't many left. But the international financial consequences of recognition were nonetheless significant, since other central banks and private bankers weren't looking for reasons to be on the Fed's bad side. Second, the logic of sanctioning the country's oil monopoly and other measures Mnuchin and Treasury were resisting would become unanswerable once we endorsed Guaido's legitimacy. To that end, I scheduled an 8 a.m. meeting on January 22nd with Pompeo, Mnuchin, Wilbur Ross, and Kudlow. Inside Venezuela, tensions were rising. In the hours before we met, there had been all-night demonstrations, including Casa de Lazos, the traditional gatherings to bang pots and pans in the poorest areas of Caracas, the original base of Chavista support. Shortages of basic goods were increasing, and demonstrators had briefly seized control of the roads to the Caracas airport. Only colectivos, the armed gangs of motorcycle thugs used by Chavez and Maduro to sow terror and intimidate the opposition, and which the opposition believed were equipped and directed by the Cubans, appeared to reopen the roads. No military. Defense Minister Vladimir Padrino, one of many Latins with Russian first names from Cold War days, and Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza had both already approached the opposition, tentatively exploring what the National Assembly's amnesty for defecting military officers would mean if the opposition prevailed. Nonetheless, after years of hostility between the two sides, there was real mistrust within Venezuelan society. With this backdrop, I asked if we should recognize Guaido when the National Assembly declared him interim president. Ross spoke first, saying it was clear we should support Guaido, immediately seconded by Kudlow and Pompeo. Happily, Mnuchin concurred, saying we had already asserted that Maduro was illegitimate, so recognizing Guaido was simply the next logical step. We didn't discuss what the economic consequences would be. Either Mnuchin didn't see the connection, or he didn't want to fight the issue. I was fine either way. With recognition resolved, we discussed other steps, working with the informal Lima group of Latin American nations for them to recognize Guaido, which took little or no convincing, adjusting the level of our travel advisory warnings, considering how to oust the Cubans, and handling the Russian paramilitaries reportedly arriving to protect Maduro. I considered the meeting a total victory. Later in the morning, I spoke with Trump, who now wanted assurances regarding post-Maduro access to Venezuela's oil resources, trying to ensure that China and Russia would not continue to benefit from their deals with the illicit Chavez-Maduro regime. Trump, as usual, was having trouble distinguishing responsible measures to protect legitimate American interests from what amounted to vast overreaching of the sort no other government, especially a democratic one, would even consider. I suggested Pence raise the issue with Guaido in the call being scheduled for later in the day, and Trump agreed. I also called several members of Florida's congressional delegation, who were coming to see Trump on Venezuela that afternoon, so they were prepared if the oil field issue arose. Senators Marco Rubio and Rick Scott and Congressman Lincoln Diaz-Balart and Ron DeSantis gave very forceful support for toppling Maduro, with Rubio saying, "This may be the last chance, and that success would be a big foreign policy win." During the meeting, they explained that the National Assembly believed many Russian and Chinese business deals had been procured through bribes and corruption, making them easy to invalidate once a new government was installed. The discussion was very helpful, and Trump agreed unequivocally to recognize Guaido, which Pence, who was attending the meeting, was fully prepared to do. Trump later added unhelpfully, "I want him to say he will be extremely loyal to the United States and no one else." Trump still wanted a military option, raising the question with the Florida Republicans, who were plainly stunned, except for Rubio, who had heard it before and knew how to deflect it politely. Later, I called Shanahan and Dunford to ask how their thinking was proceeding. None of us thought that a military option was advisable at this point. To me, this exercise was solely to keep Trump interested in the objective of overthrowing Maduro, without actually wasting a lot of time on a non-starter. The Pentagon would have to begin at square one, because under the Obama administration, Secretary of State John Kerry had announced the end of the Monroe Doctrine, a mistake that had reverberated through all of the national security departments and agencies with predictable effects. But it is proof of what some people thought was a joke when Trump later commented that I had to hold him back. He was correct on Venezuela. Dunford said politely at the end of our call that he appreciated my trying to help him understand how our military's involvement might arise. Of course, I had the easy job, closing by saying, all I had to do was make the call. Now, Dunford had the problem. He laughed and said, "Tag, I'm it." At least he still had a sense of humor. Pence asked me to join him in his office for the Guaido call, which went through about 6:15. Guaido was very appreciative of a supportive video Pence had distributed earlier over the internet, and the two had an excellent talk. Pence again expressed our support, and Guaido answered positively, if very generally, about how the opposition would perform if it prevailed. He said that Venezuela was very happy with the support the United States was providing and would work hand in hand with us, given the risks we were taking. I felt this should satisfy Trump. After the call, I leaned over Pence's desk to shake hands, saying, "This is a historic moment." He suggested we go to the Oval to brief Trump, who was quite happy with the outcome, looking forward to the statement he would make the next day. He called me about 9:25 a.m. on the 23rd to say the draft statement to be issued when the National Assembly formally invoked the Venezuelan Constitution to move against Maduro was beautiful, adding, "I almost never say that." I thanked him and said we would keep him posted. Guaido appeared before a huge crowd in Caracas, according to our embassy, the largest in the 20-year history of the Chavez-Maduro regime, and took the oath of office as interim president. The die was cast. Pence came in to shake hands, and we issued Trump's statement immediately. We feared the imminent deployment of troops, but none came, although reports indicated that overnight, colectivos killed four people. Embassy Caracas presented its credentials to the new Guaido government, along with the Lima Group ambassadors, as a show of support. I briefed Trump on the day's events at about 6:30 p.m., and he seemed to be holding firm. The next day, Defense Minister Padrino and an array of generals held a press conference to declare loyalty to Maduro, which was not what we wanted, but which to this point was not reflected in actual military activity. The opposition believed that 80% or more of the rank and file, as well as most junior officers whose families were enduring the same hardships as Venezuela's civilian population generally, supported the new government. While the percentage figure cannot be confirmed given the authoritarian nature of the Maduro regime, Guaido frequently contended he had the support of 90% of Venezuela's population overall. Top military officers, like those at the press conference, however, were likely still too corrupted by years of Chavista rule to break ranks. On the other hand, they had not ordered the military out of their barracks to crush the rebellion, likely fearing such an order would be disobeyed, which would be the end of the regime. UK Foreign Minister Jeremy Hunt, in Washington for meetings, was delighted to cooperate on steps they could take, for example, freezing Venezuelan gold deposits in the Bank of England so the regime could not sell the gold to keep itself going. These were the sorts of steps we were already applying to pressure Maduro financially. I urged Pompeo to have state more fully support the effort against the state-owned oil company, where I still worried Mnuchin was holding out, which he agreed to do. Pompeo was also disturbed by signs Maduro might be encouraging the colectivos to threaten U.S. embassy personnel, and said Trump was as well. The first troubling sign from Trump came that evening after 8:30 p.m. when he called to say, "I don't like where we are," referring to Venezuela. He worried about Padrino's press conference, saying, "The entire army is behind him." Then he added, "I've always said Maduro was tough. This kid, Guaido, nobody's ever heard of him. And the Russians have put out brutal statements." I walked Trump back off the ledge, explaining that the military was still in its barracks, which was very significant, and that senior military figures had been talking to the opposition for 2 days about what could be in it for them if they came over to the opposition or retired. Things were still very much in play, and the more time passed, the more likely it was that the military would fragment, which was what we really needed. I don't think I satisfied Trump, but I at least talked him back into silence. God only knew who he was talking to or whether he had just gotten a case of the vapors because things were still uncertain. I was sure of one thing. Any display of American indecision now would doom the entire effort. I suspected Trump knew that too, but I was amazed our policy was so close to shifting just 30-plus hours after being launched. You couldn't make this up. The next morning, I called Pompeo to tell him how Trump had all but jumped ship on Venezuela and to make sure Pompeo wasn't about to follow. Fortunately, I heard exactly the opposite reaction, Pompeo saying, "We should go to the wall to get Maduro out." Encouraged, I later asked Claver Caron to follow up with Guaido's people to ensure that they were getting out letters, the sooner the better, to the International Monetary Fund, the Bank for International Settlements, and similar institutions announcing that they were the legitimate government. Pompeo thought there was a way forward on the safety of U.S. personnel in Caracas, thus allowing us to retain a slimmed-down mission, which he wanted to do. I explained how state often became so hung up on safety issues that it made concessions on policy issues, arguing it was required to protect official staff. I certainly wasn't arguing for ignoring risks to our people, but I did believe it was better to withdraw them rather than make substantive concessions to governments like Maduro's. Just after 9 a.m., I called Trump, finding him in somewhat better shape than the night before. He still thought the opposition was beaten down, referring again to the picture of Padrino and all those good-looking generals declaring support for Maduro. I told him the real pressure was about to begin, as we imposed the petroleum sanctions, taking away a significant share of the regime's revenues. "Do it," said Trump, which was the clearest signal I needed to roll over Treasury if it was still obstructionist. On our Caracas diplomatic personnel, however, Trump wanted them all out, fearing the blowback if anything went wrong. Mostly, however, he seemed uninterested, which was explained later in the day when he announced a partial deal ending the government shutdown, interpreted across the political spectrum as a complete surrender on his Mexico border wall project. No wonder he was in a grumpy mood. I decided to call Mnuchin, who for some reason was in California again, and he agreed we had to apply oil sanctions now that we've acknowledged the new regime. I called Pompeo to tell him the good news, and he said Venezuela's foreign minister was coming to New York for the Saturday UN Security Council debate we and others had asked for. We both thought this might be an opportunity for Pompeo to see him alone and get a clear assessment of his state of mind without flunkies nearby to listen in, similar to what we were doing with other Venezuelans in diplomatic missions around the world. Because of the near certainty of Russian and probably Chinese vetoes, we didn't expect anything substantive from the Security Council, but it was a good forum to generate support for the opposition cause. Guaido helped out later in the day by calling on Cuba to take its people out of Venezuela and send them home. On Saturday, January 26th, the Security Council met at 9 a.m., and Pompeo laced into the Maduro regime. The European members said Maduro had 8 days to call elections, or they would all recognize Guaido, a considerable improvement over what we thought the EU position was. Russia blasted the meeting as an attempted coup and denounced me personally for calling for a Bolshevik-style expropriation in Venezuela. An honor, thereby showing we were on the right track going after the oil monopoly. Potentially significant was news that Venezuela's military attaché in Washington had declared his allegiance to Guaido. These and other defections brought the opposition new advocates, which, as a standard procedure, the opposition now asked to persuade officers and civilian officials still in Venezuela to bring as many of them around as he could. Unfortunately, the State Department was in a tizzy over the assurances it wanted from Maduro about the safety of our diplomatic personnel. This was not about the substance of ensuring Venezuela's government provided adequate protection, but about how to exchange diplomatic notes, completely oblivious to the broader political context. State had also held up notifying the Federal Reserve we had recognized a new government in Caracas, which was stunning. By Monday, State's Western Hemisphere Affairs Bureau was in open revolt against petroleum sanctions, arguing, as I had feared, that so doing would endanger embassy personnel. Western Hemisphere Affairs Assistant Secretary Kim Breyer wanted a 30-day delay in the sanctions, which was palpable nonsense. At first, I didn't take it seriously. But Breyer's argument seemed to be expanding by the day, with essentially anything we did to put pressure on the Maduro regime, leaving our embassy staff, most of whom by then were security personnel, not diplomats, in danger. If I were just a tad more cynical, I might have concluded Breyer and her bureau were actually trying to subvert our basic policy. Pompeo called me Saturday afternoon, uncertain about what to do about the bureaucracy's resistance. I persuaded him that the Western Hemisphere Bureau was simply playing for time. Whatever delay he agreed to would only form the basis for the next request for delay. He agreed, finally, that he was okay if we went tomorrow on the sanctions, which we did. Nonetheless, the Bureau's rebellion was not a good sign. Who knew what the bureaucracy was telling other governments, the strong left-wing Latin America think tank lobby presence in Washington, and the media? Mnuchin and I spoke several times on Monday. He had talked to oil company executives all weekend, and the sanctions would actually be more aggressive than he had first anticipated, which was good news. Predictions we could not act against the state-owned oil company because of negative impacts on Gulf Coast refiners turned out to be overstated. Having appreciated the possibility of petroleum sanctions for years, these refineries were well-positioned, in Mnuchin's words, to find other sources of oil. Imports from Venezuela were already less than 10% of their total work. In the afternoon, we were to unveil the sanctions in the White House briefing room, but I got diverted to the Oval first. Trump was very happy with how the Venezuela thing was playing in the press. He asked if we should send 5,000 troops to Colombia in case they might be needed, which I duly noted on my yellow legal pad, saying I would check with the Pentagon. "Go have fun with the press," Trump said, which we did, when my note, picked up by cameras, produced endless speculation. A few weeks later, Colombian Foreign Minister Carlos Trujillo brought me a pack of legal pads like the one I had in the briefing room, so I didn't run out. Substantively, we believed that the oil sanctions were a major blow to Maduro's regime, and many asserted that it was now just a matter of time before he fell. Their optimism was high, fueled in substantial part because they believed Maduro loyalists like Diosdado Cabello and others were sending both their financial assets and their families abroad for safety, hardly a vote of confidence in the regime. On January 30th, my office filled with people, including Sarah Sanders, Bill Shine, and Mercedes Schlapp, to listen to Trump's call to Guaido at about 9 a.m. Trump wished him good luck on the large anti-Maduro demonstrations planned for later in the day, which Trump said were historic. Trump then assured Guaido he'd pull off Maduro's overthrow and offered as an aside that he was sure Guaido would remember in the future what had happened, which was Trump's way of referring to his interest in Venezuela's oil fields. "It was a big moment in the history of the world," said Trump. Guaido thanked Trump for his calls for democracy and his firm leadership, which made me smile. Firm? If only he knew. Trump said Guaido should feel free to tell the rallies later in the day he had called, and that he looked forward to meeting Guaido personally. Guaido responded that it would be very, very moving for the people to hear that he had spoken to Trump when they fight against the dictatorship. Trump said it was an honor to talk to him, and the call ended. It was undoubtedly a boost to Guaido to announce he had spoken with Trump, which, of course, is what we intended. Guaido tweeted about the call even before Trump did, and the press coverage was uniformly favorable. At 1:30 p.m., I met with American executives of the Citgo Petroleum Corporation, which is majority-owned by Venezuela's state-owned oil company, to tell them we supported their efforts and those of the Venezuelan opposition to keep control of Citgo's refineries and service stations in the United States, thereby shielding them from Maduro's efforts to assert control. As I explained to them and others, we were also providing advice to Guaido at his request in his efforts to nominate people to the oil company's various boards of directors, which, through subsidiaries, ultimately held Citgo's ownership. I referred the executives to Wilbur Ross, whom they met the next day, for advice on avoiding the effects of a Russian government lien on Venezuela's oil company stock that might lead to a loss of control over the U.S. assets, which was right down his alley. From Moscow, we learned that Putin was allegedly very concerned about the roughly $18 billion Venezuela owed to Moscow. The estimates of the actual amounts owed varied widely, but they were all substantial. The U.S. executives told me that earlier in the day, Venezuelans loyal to Maduro, having tried unsuccessfully to divert corporate assets before they left, had fled the U.S. with one of Citgo's corporate jets headed for Caracas. I was sure we could expect more of this in the days ahead. Even Lukoil, the big Russian firm, announced it was suspending operations with Venezuela's oil monopoly, which reflected at least some desire by Russia to hedge its bets. A few days later, PetroChina, a major Chinese operation, announced it was dropping the oil monopoly as a partner for a Chinese refinery project, thus showing significant unease. Subsequently, Gazprombank, Russia's third biggest lender, closely tied to Putin and the Kremlin, froze its accounts to avoid running afoul of our sanctions. We believed Guaido and the opposition would take the opportunity to speak with Russian and Chinese diplomats and business types, stressing it was in their interest not to take sides in the intra-Venezuelan dispute. Within the U.S. government, we were also planning for the day after in Venezuela and considering what could be done to get the country's economy, in terrible disarray after 2 decades of economic mismanagement, which even Putin disparaged, back on its feet. We gave significant thought to how we could help a new government face both immediate needs for the people and also the longer-term need to repair the systemic destruction of what should have been one of Latin America's strongest economies. A drumbeat of diplomatic recognitions of Guaido was picking up, and we hoped it would demonstrate even to Maduro loyalists that his days were numbered, and also provide insurance against arrest for Guaido and other opposition leaders. This was not hypothetical. Maduro's secret police broke into Guaido's home and threatened his wife and young daughter. They were not harmed, but the signal was clear. It looked very much like a Cuban-directed operation, underscoring again that the foreign presence in Venezuela, Cuban and Russian alike, was critical to keeping Maduro in power. Protests continued throughout the country, undeterred by the prospect of Maduro's cracking down. Continuous contacts were being made with top military officers about the terms under which they could come to Guaido's side, and with former Chavista cabinet members, labor union leaders, and other sectors of Venezuelan society to build alliances. We thought the momentum remained with the opposition, but they needed to pick up the pace. In Venezuela, a plan was being developed which we thought promising, to bring humanitarian supplies across the borders from Colombia and Brazil to distribute around Venezuela. Until now, Maduro had effectively closed the borders, feasible because difficult terrain and thick forests and jungles made crossings all but impossible except at well-known and established border checkpoints. The humanitarian aid project would demonstrate Guaido's concerns for Venezuela's people and also show that the international borders were open, reflecting Maduro's increasing lack of control. There were also hopes that key military officials would not follow orders to close the borders, but that even if they did, Maduro would be placed in the impossible position of denying humanitarian supplies to his impoverished citizens. Maduro was so troubled by this strategy that he again took to criticizing me by name, saying, "I have proof that the assassination attempt was ordered by John Bolton in the White House." He was joined by Foreign Minister Arriaza, who complained, "What he's trying to do here is give us orders." Cuba was also now attacking me by name, so my spirits were high. Colombian President Iván Duque visited Trump in the White House on February 13th, and the discussion centered on Venezuela. Trump asked the Colombians if he should have talked to Maduro 6 months earlier, and Duque said unequivocally it would have been a big victory for Maduro, implying it would be an even bigger mistake to talk to him now. Trump said he agreed, which relieved me greatly. He then inquired how the effort was going overall and whether the momentum was with Maduro or Guaido. Here, Colombian Ambassador Francisco Santos was particularly effective, saying that even 2 months ago, he would have said Maduro had the edge, but he no longer believed it was true, explaining why. This clearly registered with Trump. Nonetheless, I worried our own government was not displaying a proper sense of urgency. There was, across the government, an obstructionist, not-invented-here mentality, undoubtedly in large part because under 8 years of Obama, the Venezuelan, Cuban, and Nicaraguan regimes were not seen as U.S. adversaries. Little or no attention was given to what the U.S. should do if, inconveniently, the people of these countries decided they wanted to run their own governments. Even more important, in my view, the growing Russian, Chinese, Iranian, and Cuban influence across the hemisphere had not been a priority. In effect, therefore, the Trump administration faced an avalanche of due bills in Latin America with no preparation for how to handle them. The opposition refined its thinking on how to force humanitarian aid into Venezuela from Colombia and Brazil and set Saturday, February 23rd as the target date. The Saturday prior, some 600,000 people had signed up in Caracas to help. After much coordinating between the United States Agency for International Development and the Pentagon, C-17 cargo planes were now landing at Cúcuta, one of the principal Colombian border crossing points, offloading humanitarian assistance to go across the bridges connecting the two countries. Inside Venezuela, movement toward the opposition continued. The Catholic Bishop of San Cristobal, who was also vice president of the country's Catholic Bishops' Conference, spoke publicly, specifically referring to a transition in power away from Maduro. "We had hoped the church would take a more active public role, and that now seemed to be happening." As February 23rd approached, rumors intensified of a high-level military leader, likely Venezuelan Army Commander Jesus Suarez Churio, publicly announcing that he no longer backed Maduro. There had been similar rumors before, but the humanitarian cross-border plan was the key factor why this time it might be true. Contemporaneously, Senator Marco Rubio specifically named Suarez Churio, along with Defense Minister Padrino and four others, as key military figures who could receive amnesty if they defected to the opposition. There was also some feeling that defections of this magnitude would bring a significant number of troops with them, with the military units seemingly moving toward the borders, but then doubling back to Caracas to encircle Miraflores Palace, Venezuela's White House. These optimistic forecasts, however, did not come to pass. We were doing our bit, with a Trump speech at Miami's Florida International University on February 18th, which could have been a campaign rally, so enthusiastic was the crowd. Plans for the 23rd fell into place, as Colombia's President Duque announced he would be joined at Cúcuta by the presidents of Panama, Chile, and Paraguay, and the Organization of American States Secretary General Luis Almagro. This would prove convincingly that Venezuela's revolution was hardly made in Washington. Humanitarian supplies increased on the borders, and there was evidence that Maduro's security forces intensified their harassment of non-governmental organizations inside the country. Guaido left Caracas undercover on Wednesday, heading for the Colombian border where, it was originally planned, he would wait on the Venezuelan side while the humanitarian aid came from Tianditas International Bridge from Colombia. We heard, however, that Guaido was thinking of actually crossing into Colombia to attend a Richard Branson-sponsored concert in Cúcuta on Friday night to support the assistance to Venezuela, and then leading the aid back across the border the next day, facing a confrontation with Maduro's forces, if one came, directly. This was not a good idea, for several reasons. It was very dramatic, but dangerous, not just physically, but more important, politically. Once across the border and outside Venezuela, it would likely be difficult for Guaido to get back in. What would happen to his ability to direct and control opposition policy if he were isolated outside the country, subject to Maduro propaganda saying he had fled in fear? We had no way of predicting the outcome on Saturday. It could swing from one extreme to another. Things could go well, with the border effectively opened, which would be a direct challenge to Maduro's authority, or there could be violence and bloodshed at the crossing points, potentially with Guaido arrested or worse. I thought trying to bring the humanitarian aid across the border was well conceived and entirely doable. More grandiose plans, however, were not well thought out and could easily lead to trouble.